The following is an at-will presentation.
Welcome to The Marrow, conversations with creatives about who they are and why they make what they make. I'm your host, Josh Reebok. Today, I am speaking with Mark Barboni, owner of Hudson Clearwater, a restaurant here in New York City, and more specifically, about how he got into food and how his global experiences have shaped his vision. Tell me about this whole thing, because first of all, I have eaten at Hudson Clearwater.
Oh, okay.
I have my wife and I have eaten there, and
I'm still invited in. So
you are here, and I'm not dead. So those are two positive endorsements right there. No, we actually it was fantastic. We had walked our dog down on the West End Highway. There's a couple dog parks down there,
sure.
And on our way back, it was like a brunch hour kind of on Saturday. And we came by Hudson Clearwater, and the first thing that we were drawn to was the back patio. I mean, it just felt like in the middle of New York City, for me, so often the reason I'm reluctant to dine out is because I'm looking for an oasis.
Yeah.
And I want to escape what can sometimes feel like the noise and just kind of the concrete oppression of Manhattan. And so we saw this open air back patio with little ivy growing up on the stone and these little kind of clay flower pots and a little bench. We thought that just in the physicality of it looks like exactly what we want. And so we, you know, everybody was so sweet to us. They took us back. Our dog sat, you know, out in the back near us.
Nice.
And it was amazing. And I really mean that. Like, and the food was great, but it was more for me and her that we felt like we got to have, I don't know, this kind of time of rest while still being out. I mean, I love what y'all are doing, but when did this whole idea for Hudson Clearwater, like, when was it kind of birthed? When did it bloom?
Yeah, I mean, first off, it's really nice to hear, because that was certainly an intention from the get-go for me, was to create that oasis, to create a refuge from the city noise and all of that. And in fact, to answer your question, it all came together for me. I mean, really, the original vision for it, I was living in Manhattan Beach in L.A. at the time. I had worked in hospitality since I was in college. I took a job as a busboy at the La Jolla Beach and Tennis Club there in San Diego, which was a really nice place. But, you know, I was some kid with shaggy hair and a polo shirt and khaki shorts running around like an idiot, just trying to keep all the rich folks happy. So I would do that in the summer, and then, you know, I had a manager that got mad at me for not smiling enough. And and I think touching my hair too much, but she didn't want to promote me to be a server, and you know, in hindsight, that was great, because it forced me to move on. It moved me on to become a barback at the racetrack in Del Mar, which is where I learned how to bartend, and you know, again, like a really she atmosphere where I learned a lot about just how fine dining is done. So I had that exposure at an early age, and then, that, you know, I always fell back on either serving tables or bartending. And when I came to New York back in 98, 99, you know, I tried to get a serving job, and I learned quickly that no one cares if you've ever worked in a restaurant outside of New York. You know, the general mentality is like, oh, you haven't done it in New York. Sorry. Yeah, sorry. Good luck. Keep looking. I'm like, well, how do you break in?
Yeah, right.
And I did get a job working at some outdoor cafe or something, but it was seasonal only. That wrapped up quickly. I ended up making some connections and working in interior design for a while, which is totally bizarre. And the guy that I worked with went on to become really famous and have his own TV show and the whole bit. So it was a good experience. I was obviously with a very talented person and learned a lot, but I just did that for about 6 months and quickly realized I could make more bartending. I had to try and get back into that. And ended up walking into Bond Street in NoHo, the sushi joint. And, of course, they're not hiring. You've never worked in New York. Sorry, we can't do anything. I literally had to beg my way to get in there. And I said, listen, like, you're going to have people that call out sick. I'm sure you have people that go on vacation. Just train me up. I'll be the guy that jumps in. You don't have to give me any standard shifts. I'll be the guy that jumps in. So, you know, I kind of won over the manager there, and he let me do that. And in a short amount of time, I ended up getting on the schedule and working, and I ended up having a really long-term relationship with those guys, and they were great mentors. I learned a lot about the business, I worked there on and off. I ended up leaving and going to Spain for about 8 months. And again, leaving the industry completely, worked with a photographer out there. Just it all came together serendipitously. I had no idea. I didn't buy a return ticket. I had no idea what I would do for work. Heard that this photographer that I knew, who actually had got me an interior design job many years before, that he was out there. And so I met up with him and made myself useful. He decided it was worthwhile having me around and wrote me into the budget and asked me to assist him. So everything came into place. I did that for a while, came back, and got in with the Bond Street guys. They were always so gracious in taking me back. Mm-hmm. And then helped them open a place in the meatpacking district, which, you know, back then it still smelled like meat. You know, there's guts in the street and blood in the gutters and rats everywhere.
Did you like that? Did you like that it was kind of like this restaurant amongst like a gritty environment?
Well, it was a lounge, but yes and no. It was cool. It was cool. The edginess of it was certainly appealing, and I respected that artistic component of it and that they were diving in and doing something creative in a really nasty area. Mm-hmm. But I like being around beautiful things, so I definitely had to hold my breath a little going to work. But it was cool. I got to see, that was the first time I had seen the build-out of a place, got to chime in here and there on the design of the bar and whatnot, and, you know, was opening bartender there. And then helped another friend open a nightclub, but really passively, just a little advice here and there, was never really involved in it too much. And then I was interning at a documentary film place, which was fantastic and still something I fantasize about is working in documentary film.
But it seems like through all this, though, because this is like fascinating to me, because it's like I love the way you talk about these things so nonchalantly. It's like, well, I moved to New York and, well, it didn't work out. So, yeah, I spent 8 months in Spain with this photographer and you're doing interior design. And then, like, but I mean, so in the midst of all this, it seems like, and maybe I'm inferring something that's not true, but it seems like this kind of being around food and hospitality is kind of, I don't know if haunting you is the word, but beckoning you the whole time. Yeah. Like, this is where you belong. I mean, is that true?
For sure. And, you know, especially that it was an anchor for me. You know, I had this extremely unstable career path, I guess, you know, and I was going to be a doctor. I was studying medicine in college and biology and whatnot, and it was kind of a shock to my parents, my dad especially, when I said, you know what, Dad, I think I'm going to go bartend for a while, you know. You can imagine how that goes over.
Yeah, a biology major and a bartending minor.
And I didn't really let go of that. In fact, at one point I had left New York. I went and I did an EMT course in Orange County. Because I wanted some more exposure to medicine and to see if that was really what was going to fit. I was thinking about the Peace Corps, all this crazy stuff. But like I said, hospitality was the anchor. It was always the thing I could fall back on. And it was the only way that I was able to pursue all these crazy ideas and explore different lifestyles and still feel like I was going to make it. Like I was going to find a way to eat. I was going to find a way to pay the rent. And I mean, when I came back from Costa Rica, I had nothing. I remember I had to roll change to be able to put gas into my car, you know, and I had a car still, but, you know, it was like my last dollars paid the insurance. I rolled my quarters. I got me my first tank of gas. I drove back to San Diego and I got a bartending job and, you know, and then I was back on my feet again. I was sleeping on my friend's floors like you were talking about before. So, you know, it was fun. It was invigorating. I learned so much about people, about what it's like to struggle, about taking chances and risks, and really, you know, letting go of a very structured life that I had always enjoyed. And it was challenging. It was hard. And there were a lot of long, lonely walks through the city where I was wondering, what am I doing with myself? And I remember when 25 hit, too, I was like, God, like, I have not even begun to get this sorted out yet. Like, how am I ever going to support a family?
Was there a temptation then to just sign up for more of the traditional 9-to-5 and just to quote, you know, be an adult? Or, I mean,
yeah,
I mean,
what was that like? It was absolutely always beckoning. And you know, my parents were really cool. My mom especially supportive. My dad always a little more cautious, not in a non-supportive way, but, you know, hey, Mark, you know, you don't want to be a bartender forever, do you? Mm-hmm. Like, what are you going to do with yourself? you know, in New York, you're exposed to so many different ways of living and so many unique people, and most of them are really motivated and pushing hard at something. So that's always been really inspirational for me.
Is food art?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And I think that chefs are artists above everything else. And I think that owners often forget that, because here you are coming to this artist and saying, hey, you know, I need you to create this beautiful menu, this beautiful dish. It has to look good, it has to taste good, it has to be sexy, it has to be stunning, it has to be savory, whatever. And at the same time, I need you to manage the budget for the kitchen. I need you to figure out the costing. So you're asking this person to adopt two different headspaces. One as an artist, and one as like this very technical business manager. And I think it's part of the struggle for a lot of restaurants is how do you find someone that's capable of both? And I really, I think it's a pretty unrealistic expectation of restaurant owners to try and force someone to be both the artist and the businessman. But unfortunately, that's kind of the model that's accepted right now, and budgets revolve around that being the same person, especially in a smaller establishment. But yeah, to answer your question, absolutely.
Food, yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, I love that. My food experience growing up was, you know, fairly limited in the context that it was worked within the parameters of my parents' context of what food was. And so I remember when I would at night, you know, be kind of like, well, what are we going to eat for dinner? My dad would say, do you want me to make you a sandwich? I'd say, yeah, you know, Dad, would be awesome. I'd love a sandwich. And for my dad, that meant two pieces of, you know, untoasted Roman meal bread and a piece of Velveeta cheese between it, you know, and just handing it, there's your sandwich. And for me, there was never like this, I don't know, feeling that I was missing out. That was just my understanding. That was my template for what food was. And then years later, when I started dating the girl that would become my wife, I remember the first time she said, do you want to eat sushi? And I looked at her and I said, I don't even know what that is. And she took me, and it wasn't even like some, you know, swanky thing. She like picked it up, and we like sat on like a rock in a park, and we ate sushi together. And that's one of my most vivid memories of going, there's a lot more that people, like whoever made this, there's a lot more that they put into it than I've ever realized about food.
Yeah.
Like food isn't just major corporations. Food is, like you said, to your point, it's people with a vision for what food can be. It's people with an artistry to it. It's people with a wild imagination who are able to create something that then provides not only taste, but meaning. But it's so funny how, everybody has a different learning curve. I mean, with everything, but with food, I feel like I was definitely a late bloomer on the food experience side of things.
It's not dissimilar for me. I mean, you know, through college, you're just trying to survive. You're just trying to eat enough to not wither away. And I cooked all through college, motivated to save money. And I guess that started in high school because I was just hungry all the time. So you come home, you cook yourself something up. Also, my parents divorced when I was like 13. So to help out, we started cooking a lot. When I was out of school, you know, I'm down in Costa Rica, and believe me, they're not known for their cuisine down there. You know, it's fine. It's gallo pinto, you know, rice and beans, and maybe if you're lucky, you get a fresh caught fish on top. But I remember, like you, coming back, and I was in San Diego, and I went out to eat with a girl, and I didn't even know we were going to a sushi joint. I had no idea what it was, but she's like, do you want edamame? And I'm like, edo what?
Yeah.
I had no idea. She's like, you don't know what edamame is? And, you know, I was 21, 22, 22, mm-hmm. I guess now. And I never had sushi. I never had edamame. I was, you know, mm-hmm. and I had it, and I was like, oh, this is tasty. And, you know, it wasn't a great sushi place, so mm-hmm. I wasn't blown away. But I did get to see that, oh, you know, people do put a lot of effort into making this look beautiful.
Yeah.
And I remember being frustrated because I'm like, how do you get filled up on some raw fish and white rice? Like, that's never going to satiate me. And even when I started at Bond Street, I mean, here I was at one of the best sushi places in the city, and I didn't have an appreciation for it. And little by little, though, I started to learn what a great pleasure it can be. And, you know, being in a Japanese restaurant, talk about a place where people really work hard to make food art. Mm-hmm. And to inspire people, not just through their palate, but visually. Oh, so, yeah. That was a great experience for me.
So I gotta like force you back into your Costa Rican era here.
Okay.
Because there's something fascinating that you spent time in Costa Rica, then you opened a restaurant in Manhattan. So tell me about how your time in Costa Rica influenced your vision for Hudson Clearwater and your restaurant here.
Yeah, I mean, wow. I think that as I was saying earlier, what I took away most from Costa Rica was how something so simple could be so fulfilling. Because here you had all these people that lived off nothing, and all they had was family, friends, sense of community, and you know, the plot of land that they grew their coffee on, and yet they were so happy, they were so fulfilled, and I think that really helped me realize that it's not all about, you know, the bells and whistles, the flashiness, the, you know, the expensive furniture or the fine china. Mm-hmm. What it really is about is creating a sense of community, and that was really the governing part of the creative vision for Hudson Clearwater, was how do we create this amazing sense of community, and create a space that allows people to escape that competitive grind of the rest of the city. Mm-hmm. And that was all part of that initial vision that I wrote one day. And, you know, it was also heavily inspired by a trip to Brazil that I took and South America that I took shortly before I started working on the vision. And, you know, again, down there, it's about community, getting together, relaxing, taking the time to enjoy a mojito and some oysters while watching the sunset. You know, I actually even put that in the original vision statement.
Really?
Yeah.
So did it actually say, like, think: oysters, mojitos, watching the sunset?
Yeah, something like that.
Like
I
that?
Mean, it's, I guess to get back to how it all came together. So you've heard how I was back here and working with the sushi guys and then opening the place in the meatpacking district. So, you know, then I was back in L.A. and I started this business again. And I really did it for about 7 years. I was in Manhattan Beach, completely away from hospitality. And my business was based out of the house, so to be honest, it was quite lonely. I mean, I had employees. At one point, I had four guys that were working there at the house for me. I had a warehouse at one point in time. All this stuff, but it never had that sense of community like a restaurant can provide. And the Bond Street guys ended up opening a place in Beverly Hills. So I had stayed in touch with them and basically got a phone call saying, hey, you know, we're doing this place on Wilshire. Do you want to come and be involved? And I was reluctant at first. Especially about the idea of coming into management or anything like that. I said, you know, I'm too busy. I'm doing this, that, the other thing. I don't really have time. They said, well, how about just helping with special events and bartending on Friday nights or something? So I said, okay, I'll do it. And with some apprehension, I mean, I didn't know if I still had the chops. So I got in there, and funny enough, the guy working the bar with me was a guy I had bartended with in New York who had relocated to L.A., and I hadn't even known it. So we jumped right back into the old dance, you know. It's so much fun. It's so much fun to be behind a busy bar with someone that you jive with, really dancing and, you know, and making it happen.
Do you come alive, like, when you're back there? I mean, is it like a dimension of Mark that doesn't necessarily come out in a lot of places comes out there?
I mean, I don't turn into Tom Cruise in Cocktail or anything.
Oh, come on, man. Just
I wish.
Just
I wish
for
I
my
had those
sake,
skills.
Just tell me that you do.
But, you know, one thing I say about bartending is that it's a fantastic job in that you have to, your job above anything else, I mean, obviously you have to make drinks, but the social aspect of your job is to take whatever negativity anyone might dump on you and turn it into something positive so that you're inspiring people, you're helping them deal with whatever hardship they're exposed to right now. You're assuring them that it's okay. You're playing that part of the psychologist. And so when you're doing that day in and day out, it causes you to look for the good in everything. I think you enjoy life a lot more when you're always looking for the good in things.
Do you feel like you're a natural optimist?
No. Unfortunately.
Really?
Yeah, I think that I tend to be hypercritical and that naturally, and again, maybe it's something I inherited from my engineer father, but my natural state is to try and find what's wrong and fix it. But, you know, I think that's why I kind of forced myself into that atypical life when I was young, is that the easy road was to follow who I was kind of raised to be, which was keep everything neat, organized, orderly, go with a secure job, go with a secure life, the guaranteed paycheck. And so I enjoyed going out on a limb there and challenging myself. And it made me question the life that I had known and really allowed me to see both sides. Hmm. And I think that so many artists, that's the life they live. They don't know where the next paycheck is coming from. They have no idea if anyone's going to like what they create. Mm-hmm. They have no idea if they're going to have a place to sleep tomorrow. They depend on their friends. And, you know, I always admired that, and I respected it, and I wanted to experience myself. You know, I wish I had what it took to be a professional musician or something. And while I was a musician and I got a minor in music, it was never... I can never play to the level that I can make a living at that. But I always had a great appreciation for the arts.
In this process, did you ever reach a point where you wanted to quit?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What was the low point? I mean, because, like, again, this is like some people, you know, they often say about writers, which I am, they often say, like, well, why does someone become a writer? And usually what they say is, well, I guess they failed at everything else.
Yeah.
But, like, for you, I mean, it's evident in hearing you talk, like, I mean, this was a choice amongst many different, you know, routes you could have gone, but you chose this. And even, you know, as it got hard, and even as you hit moments where maybe you wanted to quit, you kept going. So it's fascinating to me that you perhaps didn't choose the easiest route, but there's something in you that kept you going. But so, like, what kept you going in those moments when it was really hard? And tell me about, like, some of these moments, like these low moments for you in the process.
Yeah, I think two things really helped me persevere. One is that having had all these other experiences, as you said, this was a conscious choice. And I knew that if I didn't keep on, that I was going to fall back to that kind of no man's land where I'm stuck in the doldrums trying to mm-hmm. figure out what it is I'm going to pursue. And I think that happens with so many creative people nowadays is they have an idea about something, but they're not quite confident enough to sink everything into it. Hmm. And for me, this was an all-in gamble, and that's what it took is just kind of, you know, when you first have a vision for something, you're like, is that a good idea? Should I really be doing this? And you talk to your closest friends or lover, whoever it is, about it, and maybe they say, yeah, you know, I think that's all right, honey, or whatever it is. Or you're crazy, but, I mean, that's a really bad idea. And sometimes you have to choose to ignore those people even early on. Yeah. And many times you kind of readjust and you think about, you try and address the negativity that some people have, and you try and get your head around something that you really believe in. And that's what I did is, you know, it started off with an idea, and I think the vision from the get-go was pretty good. And you start fine-tuning it, you shop it around, you test it with your confidants, and you make adjustments to it. And then by the time that you, for me at least, by the time that I was really in the face of the worst opposition, I didn't care what anyone else thought anymore. Mm. Because at that point, I was so vested and I believed so strongly in what we were doing that no one could tell me to stop. Mm. And, I mean, it's amazing how many people tell you will fail. Or they think you're just that other guy that, oh, yeah, you know, Josh was telling me how he's going to write a book. It'll probably never happen.
Right.
Guys talk about this all the time. I doubt he's actually doing it.
Right.
And then
right.
The next thing they know, they see that you're published somewhere, and you're like, ha, I persevere.
Yeah, right.
And it's because you reach a point where you believe with such conviction that no one can tell you that you can't anymore, you know?
Mm.
And I say that it's a bit like that Peter Pan movie where your vision for what you want is so vivid that you can almost see it, touch it.
Yeah, right.
I would walk through this space when we were creating it, and I was walking around the bar already, even though it wasn't built yet. But in my head, it was there. I could touch it. I could see it, you know, and these little things. And then when someone comes in and tells you it's not going to work or this is a bad idea or you should do this, that, the other thing, you're like, no, man, it's already here.
Yeah,
It's right in my head, and I can see it with my eyes before me. Hmm. And your inability to see that it can work is because you're unable to imagine it the way that I am.
Yeah.
And so you just stop caring. So that carries you through those hard times. And, you know, similarly, when you feel that there's a greater purpose to what you're doing, that carries you through the lows, you know. It's like I'm not just doing this to make money. I'm doing this to create a sense of place for people. I'm doing this to be that anchor for young people that are struggling the way that I did when I was here. And you start to feel this obligation to the community, to other young people out there, to you know, and to I felt it to myself, to my partners. And that was something that was so special about finding the guys that I did, my brother being one, but also Matt and Chris, who they very much got on board with that vision. And they're sensitive guys. They they've had a very different background than I did, but the four of us believed so strongly in creating this sense of place that it becomes bigger than any individual. It becomes more important than your bad day. And so, you know, you don't want to stand in the way of something great. So you just keep pushing on and pushing on.
Did you have the moment, where you got to kind of step back? Maybe it was the soft opening, maybe it was the hard opening, maybe it was months later. And maybe it was a private moment. Maybe it was something completely innocuous where you got to just kind of step back for one moment from all the hard work you had invested and just kind of let the joy of what y'all had accomplished like kind of rush over you.
Yeah, I remember two times in particular, and one was that first night when we first opened and we had people in the space. And you know, we were doing construction right up to that last second, and I was covered in dust and, you know, hanging things on the wall and sanding something and whatever it was. And I remember I ran out of there. People started to arrive. I ran out to go home and shower and get changed up. And when I came back into the space, I was like, wow, you know, we did it. Here it is. Like, you know, and when you first have that group of people in a space that you created, it's so invigorating. It's such an amazing feeling. And you see them and you see the smiles everywhere. And, you know, Matt and Chris were behind the bar bartending and just, you know, doing what they needed to do so well. And John's out on the floor socializing, and everything was happening, and everyone was happy, and everyone was exciting. And, yeah, I mean, it makes it all worthwhile, for sure.
Yeah, well, and I would think, I mean, then all of a sudden, a fork, you see it in action. It's not just being unwrapped from plastic, yeah. You know, that came in from a distributor, but all these, like, or even, I mean, take me, you know, who's eating out on your back patio. Now it's not just, you know, brick and concrete and steel tables. Now all of a sudden it's like someone making use of what was a very intentional decision. So, sometimes for me, you know, Mark Twain said the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the same difference between lightning and lightning bug. And in the same way, there are times when I go, why do I labor over these three words in a, you know, 400-page novel? Why do I labor over this? Because I know what takes me, you know, hours to create, people are going to pass over in seconds. Why does it matter? And part of it is I love it. I love the work. But part of it is I believe in what my love for that work, even in the tiniest minutia kind of way, what that can create. Even if it's just in a moment's time for another person.
Yeah.
And to me, it's like if you don't, I mean, I can't imagine the mania that sets in if you don't believe that. It's like, why else invest so much of yourself in this work if you don't believe that somehow that extra sweat can produce something meaningful in the life of another person?
Yeah, right? And I think this is what separates the creators and the doers from those that the don't believe in visions and they end up not accomplishing anything. You know, my brother, he's an architect, and he told me, you know, people always say the devil's in the details, and he told me one time, he said, architects say God is in the details. And it's not unlike what Mark Twain said, you know. Yeah. it's these subtle little differences that separate greatness from, you know, just mediocre.
Do you believe in God, Mark?
I do, yeah, but it's I don't necessarily see an old man up in the sky, nor do I see the Catholic God that's punishing you for your sins. I guess I quantify God as being just some sort of energy out there that I guess we each have a part of in us and that we each make up part of.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and I ask, because, I mean, even in parks, I'm curious, but also just when you talk, like it call it whatever you want, but it does seem like there is something deep in you driving you, you know, through all this to even make it more about you, mm-hmm. you know, to make it about the people around you, to kind of whatever your concept of God is, to be an extension of that in Manhattan and for your family as well.
Yeah. And, you know, oftentimes God could just simply be the good in people, you know, and I try and nurture the good in myself and the good in others and encourage people to share that good with each other. So I think that's what God is. There was a little boy that I was close to when I was in sixth grade, so 12 years old. He was about 6 years old, and he ended up dying of leukemia. And he was in remission when we first met him, and then he fell back into it. And you know, you go through an experience like that as a young person, mm-hmm. and you really start to question death and God and spirituality and, you know, mm-hmm. try to figure out what it's all about. So it's certainly something that heavily impacted my life and has since always caused me to question what's important, mm-hmm. what matters. You know, if I'm on my deathbed tomorrow, what will I look back on and really care about?
Yeah.
And again, you know, this is why you don't stop. This is why when you finally have something that you believe in that will kind of fill that spot in your own heart as well as provide for others, you don't let, you know, an angry plumber who's being difficult stand in your way, you know. You're like, no, man, just put the pipe over there. That's how it's going to be. Get it done. And, you know, you don't worry about not sleeping and not having any money or any of that. You just keep pushing on because you believe in it. And, you know, I think that's part of what, thankfully, what somehow came through and what we created at Hudson Clearwater that separates it from so many other restaurants. More and more nowadays, especially in Manhattan, restaurants are part of a bigger group. I mean, mm-hmm. most people don't realize it, but most successful restaurants in the city now are part of a group. Mm-hmm. And it's moving towards chain restaurants. Mm-hmm. And it's not like it's just all McDonald's, but you can't create a restaurant that's one of six in a group and have it have that same soul. Mm-hmm. The place like Hudson Clearwater does.
Mm.
And, you know, when you have four people that are putting all of themselves into creating something, and, I mean, we designed it, we built it, we did the interior design, we ran it in the beginning, and I still run it now, and the other guys are still involved, you get a very different product than you do when, you know, you have a fund or a budget or an investment group, and they say, yeah, you know, this has worked well. Let's go bang out four more of these.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it becomes business then instead of a work of love.
Well, and that's when an experience you had as a 12-year-old boy, that's when time in Costa Rica actually gets represented in my dining experience there.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't get kind of filtered out through 17,000 other voices and just become another kind of homogenized experience. Are you familiar with an individual in Greek mythology named Procrustes?
No.
So I, you know, this is like, I drive my wife crazy. If she ends up in a mental institution, it's because I tell her random facts and ask her, you know, vocabulary words. But this individual named Procrustes, he, in Greek mythology, he stood at the edge of a bridge and he had this bed that he would offer to travelers who were winding their way from one point in their voyage to another. He would say, hey, you know, you're free to stay in my bed for the night. And so they would lay down in bed, and while they slept, he would cut off their legs or arms in order that they would fit the bed frame perfectly. And so his obsession was getting everyone to fit in this frame. So it's really like a horrifying story. Yeah. We actually have like a current vocabulary where like a modern term of vocabulary based on that. It's called Procrustean. And if you call something Procrustean, it basically means that it's rigidly fit to be uniform just like everything else. And, you know, what you're describing in the food industry is like the modern Procrustes outpouring in food is where we go, it's all going to be like this. It's all going to be like this. Or with movies, it's all going to be like this. They're all going to be 2 hours. They're all going to have their moment of final conflict 12 minutes from the end. And then they're going to kind of flow out. And there is something, while that can produce a lot of good, culturally, I think we forsake so much and lose so much in the process. And I think it's what you're describing. It's we lose that it's not just a restaurant. It's the restaurant with Mark's unique passions, not only for the food, but for how the people would experience food. And when that plays out, I think it's amazing.
Yeah, and I think that one of the biggest fears when you're investing so much is that people aren't going to notice it, that somehow it's not going to come through, and that you're putting in all this extra effort and heart and soul, you know, in vain, because no one's going to pick up on it. So it's you know, we started today with you offering some really nice compliments, and it makes it worthwhile. You're like, yes, another guy got it.
Yeah.
And believe me, there's a million people that come through there that don't get it, or maybe they don't consciously get it. They're just like, yeah, it was cool. Like, I like that. And there's the people that come through, they're like, oh, I can't believe they don't have leather booths and that it's so tight in here, or that there's not a big chandelier hanging, or that they're not all in uniforms or whatever. So, you know, you can't appeal to everyone, but if you try to appeal to everyone, then you forsake, you know, what you believe in. So I think that in the same way that no one wants only pop music.
Yeah.
You know, people want the artists to go out on a limb, that just do what speaks to them. I try to take the same approach with what we do with the restaurant. And as much as I learned working with all these other establishments, I didn't necessarily always just go to how I'd known it was done. I tried to approach it like, okay, does that really make sense? Can't we simplify it more? Can't we make this easier for the staff? It's worked. So,
I mean, I my wife and I live in the West Village, so we cherish the fact that y'all are in the West Village, and to me, you are a shining example of what Charles Bukowski, the poet and novelist from the 1960s, said when he said, "Find what you love and let it kill you." And you've given so much of your life to this, not only because you love it, but because you believe that by loving it, it can create meaning for other people. And so thank you so much for your time, Mark.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, and thank you for inviting me in and taking a moment to listen.
Thanks so much for listening to The Marrow. To find me on social media for upcoming live appearances or to buy a book, you can visit joshreebach.com. But please join me again next week.
I'm Missy Modell. Listen to That One Song. Conversations with people about the music that has marked their lives every Thursday on At Will Radio. That One Song.